Truly, it's an honor to be here to initiate the IFRI sequence of lectures this year. It's also an honor to see some of you, see all of you in the audience. What I meant to say is there are some people in the audience who could also give the talk as well as I, so it's an honor to see you here as well. The subject on the origin of life, how life originated, is really a subject that has broad interest. It's not just the scientist that are interested in the subject, but you'll find that it also has interest to the theologian, it has interest to the philosopher, it has interest to the person on the street. It has interest to me personally as an astronomer because many of the arguments that are used to support what we would call a naturalistic origination for life, that is one where life arose without any deity, is something that I run across quite a bit in my astronomy reading. Astronomers are interested in, as you will see, because much of the evidence that is promoted in order to show that life could have arisen on Earth simply by chance through various chemical processes does come from astronomy. And so as an astronomer, I am interested. I've also found that whatever college textbook in astronomy that I have reviewed to see whether I would use it for my course or not, I always find that there are two interesting subjects towards the end of the text. The first one is, how did life originate on Earth? And the second interesting question that the astronomy text tries to deal with is, has life arisen elsewhere in the galaxy, and are we able to communicate with it? Those are two very broad topics. I will not in any way handle the second topic, but the first topic on how life arose on Earth is something that is discussed quite a bit in the popular literature. It's not only an astronomy text, you will find it in a good number of biology texts as well. And then also to show that it is a subject that is interesting to what we would call the common person, the person on the street, you will also see that on television, quite a number of programs have dealt with the subject as well. The one that comes to mind is the one called Cosmos by Carl Sagan. The second sequence of that particular series had to do with the origin of life. A proposal as to how life originated on Earth strictly through chemical means, that is, natural chemical type of physical laws. And then David Attenborough's show, Life on Earth, also begins with that particular scenario. And even though there are many proposals as to how life originated on Earth, I want to deal primarily with one proposal, and that is the proposal that I call the standard scenario. And that is to say, it is the scenario, it is the explanation that you find in the popular literature. It is the one that is presented with great conviction and almost it's presented in such a way that you're really out of step if you don't believe it. And so what I want to do today is I want to present strictly the standard scenario, what you see on Cosmos, what you see on life on Earth, what you read in standard college astronomy or biology texts. This is what I am going to present, hopefully in a very persuasive way, perhaps even provocative way, because there is a lot of evidence in favor of that particular proposal. So I want to present it in a persuasive way, in an honest way. I think I'll stay away from the term provocative, given what's happened to Judge Bork lately. But at any rate, I want to present the evidence as it is given, and then I want to present what I feel are some telling arguments against that particular scenario. Again, at the risk of sounding boring, let me repeat myself. I'm dealing with what is known as the standard scenario. And so I'm not going to get into the Cairns-Smith version of using clay as a means by which life could have originated. I'm not going to get into the Eigen hypercycles as to how life originated. I'm dealing primarily with the standard scenario. So with that as introduction, perhaps somebody can turn on the projector, and then we'll get started. The very first slide that you see actually is a chapter in a very recent book. By recent, I mean late 86, a man by the name of Cutter, who wrote a book, The Universe and the Origin of Life. What Cutter does is to present a popular view of astronomy in the first half of the book, and then he goes on to show how certain astronomical laws have led to the origin of life here on Earth. This is the heading of one of his chapters, The Origin of Life on Earth, and I will be presenting what Cutter, in his very recent book, has presented, and also adding in material that I have found from numerous other authors that have dealt with the subject as well. Before we get started, I suppose we ought to say something about the cell. This is just a cutaway view of a cell, just to show that a cell is a very complicated structure. There are various parts of a cell that do different things, and they all work together very, very nicely. In fact, the division of labor is so good in a cell that it would probably make a vertically integrated conglomerate green with envy to see how well a cell works together. And there are parts of the cell that have the information as to what the cell is going to do, what it's going to do with products that it ingests, that it takes in, how it is going to divide. There are other parts of the cell that serve as structure. There's still other parts of the cell that serve as the power factory of the cell, where food is taken and combined with oxygen in order to give us power, or in order to give the cell power, etc. My basic point is to say that the cell is a very complicated structure, and no one really believes that, who believes in chemical evolution, believes that cells just originated with the snap of the fingers. Basically, those who believe that cells eventually arose on Earth through chemical means believe that there were steps, and basically these steps led from less complicated structures to more complicated structures. And so the whole scenario really revolves around starting with simple material that is unorganized, organizing it into more complex material that becomes even more complex in its organization, that eventually gives rise to simple cells, and then the simple cells evolve into more complex cells, and the complex cells then aggregate into complex structures, from the lowly worm to human beings that are extremely complex in their structure. In order to understand a little better what is going on, and perhaps the projector could be moved over this way a little bit. I'm sorry that when I line things up, I wound up lining it up on a slide that wasn't exactly centered. In order to understand a little better as to what is going on in the cell, what we have here are the principal chemical constituents of life. I'm not so much interested in the composition of the constituents as I am in their function. And basically, if you look at the column on the left, you find what is absolutely necessary for a cell to function. First of all, you need water. Water serves as a solvent that basically allows the cells to take material from one part to another, and also for cells to communicate this material between themselves. We need carbohydrates, which are basically sugars and starch, for an energy source, and we need fats for energy storage, and we need proteins. And the proteins have two functions. First of all, they are structural. That is to say, they make up the object, they make up the cell, the parts of the cell, and then also they serve as chemical facilitators. That is to say, they allow certain reactions to take place more quickly, which is what a cell needs in order to survive. The term that I'm particularly interested that you remember concerning proteins are, first of all, amino acids, and second, the term enzymes. Basically, proteins and enzymes are made of amino acids. Amino acids are the basic building block of the proteins and of the enzymes, and the enzymes are the chemical facilitators. They act a little bit like catalysts. And then finally, we also need nucleic acids, and these are the materials that are in the center of a cell, the nucleus of a cell, and the function of the nucleic acids are to give the pattern for the cell to do what it's supposed to do, either in its function or in its dividing. In fact, the nucleic acids, which form DNA, a term that I'm sure you're familiar with, that form DNA, that pattern of DNA in the nucleus of a cell is basically what controls the cell. It contains the information that controls what a cell is going to be doing. So what I'm particularly interested in is that you remember the functions of the nucleic acids, basically DNA. RNA is just another version of it that does slightly different things. and also the terms amino acids, because I'll be using those quite a bit. Just in a nutshell, the way a cell functions to build up the proteins and to build up enzymes is as follows, given diagrammatically on this particular slide. In the upper left, you have the DNA. The DNA material is like a spring coil that is in the nucleus, a so-called double helix, again like a spring. And basically what happens, the information in the DNA is transferred to what is known as messenger RNA. And the messenger RNA then goes to these sites that look a little bit like dumbbells, but with one dumbbell a little more weighty than the other. And in that particular structure, you find that the messenger RNA, which again contains the information from the cell, is able to be translated, and then that information is used to take amino acids, such as you see illustrated over here to the right center. That information tells the amino acids basically how to group together. And it is the sequence of amino acids that becomes critical towards forming the material that is necessary for the proteins, either for the enzymes or for the structural material. And so basically you have this working together of the DNA, of various kinds of RNA, in order to form the amino acids. And as I say, the amino acids have to be in a particular chain, that is to say, in a particular sequence, in order to do the function that it is supposed to do in a cell. Now, how do we form amino acids? First of all, let's take a look at the amino acids. My talk from here on is going to focus on the formation of amino acids and not on the formation of nucleic acids, that is the DNA. If I have time at the end, I will say a few words about that. The standard scenario at this point is going to focus in only on the amino acids and how amino acids not only may have formed on the Earth in times past, but also how they might have aggregated on the Earth in times past in order to perform the functions that they are supposed to when grouped together to give a cell eventually. First of all, just a diagram on the amino acids. The green box basically outlines the part of all the amino acids that are similar. That particular material in the green box is similar to all amino acids. There are 20 amino acids that are necessary for life as we know it. And they differ structurally, except for the green box. There is a particular material there which differentiates amino acids from other kinds of material. And this is the material that we are speaking of when we are talking about its being linked together, one after another, in a chain, in order to perform a specific function within a cell. How are we going to form amino acids? The scenario starts in the very early Earth. As astronomers, we are quite certain that the early Earth was originally molten, and as a result of the heat that was generated, we not only had magma, or molten rock, or lava, that was coming to the surface, but the interior heating of the Earth also released a lot of water and also released a lot of gases. Now, the gases that are released are not the gases that we see today, except for nitrogen. Basically, the gases that are released would be devoid of oxygen. Critical thing to remember is that oxygen is not considered to have been part of the original atmosphere of the Earth. The reason is that our oxygen is what the chemist calls very reactive. That is to say, it combines very readily with other materials. And in the early history of the Earth, first of all, there would be a lot of molten rocks around, and those molten rocks would have quite a bit of iron in them, and magnesium, and silicon. And iron and magnesium and silicon is able to grab oxygen and basically take it out of the atmosphere. And so the early Earth is not thought to have oxygen in it, but rather it would have nitrogen. It would have carbon dioxide, it would have carbon monoxide, and also it would have a couple other gases that would be part of the material out of which the Earth formed, and those gases would be hydrogen, you'd have some helium also, but that does not involve itself in any reactions. You would also have methane, and you would have ammonia. And so the major gases that we are going to deal with then that were present in the early atmosphere are precisely those, nitrogen, methane, ammonia, carbon dioxide, and carbon monoxide, along with plenty of water. So what happens in this early atmosphere? If you have a lot of water, you eventually are going to get clouds that not only contain water, but also contain numerous of the gases that I've mentioned. And these gases are going to begin to react with one another. They are going to react primarily through sunlight, such as shown here, and through lightning. And the scenario goes as follows. As a result of the sun's energy, the chemical bonds between the simple molecules that I have mentioned break down, and then these molecules are supposed to recombine, and they will recombine to form amino acids. A diagram of this is shown in front of you. Notice the sunlight coming into the top, and in the cloud you have water, carbon dioxide, you have ammonia, you have a gas also which was thought to have existed in the early Earth, a gas called cyanogen, hydrogen, carbon, and nitrogen together. You may add ammonia to this, you may add hydrogen to this, you may add numerous gases to this, but you may not add oxygen to this mixture. The reason being, again, because we don't think oxygen existed, and also, very critically, because oxygen present in the early atmosphere would destroy amino acids. Now, that may seem somewhat strange because we all depend upon oxygen to exist. But in reality, if cells were not very careful in the way they handled oxygen, cells would be destroyed. The very material that makes up the cell is destroyed by oxygen. Cells have learned to take care of oxygen in particular locations where it does not interfere with other parts of the cell. And so the cells can use oxygen, but oxygen loosely incorporated into a cell is very destructive. And it is also very destructive to amino acids. So here's the scenario. We have the sunlight or we have the lightning. The simple molecules that are illustrated here break down and then reform into amino acids. The rain then brings the amino acids down into the ocean, where the ocean then protects the amino acids from further sunlight. The reason being because sunlight can also break down amino acids as well as it can break down simple molecules. So the ocean then becomes a protector of the amino acids that have formed. However, the amount of amino acids that would be in the early ocean would be very, very small. We would have a very dilute soup, as people have called it, but a very, very dilute soup where the amino acids are so spread out that they would not have a chance to interact with one another because there's too much distance between them. And so even though we have the ocean having amino acids added to it, they are not concentrated enough to do anything. And so we need a concentrating mechanism for the amino acids. The concentrating mechanism will be tidal pools. Now, before I get to that, I just want to show you the type of reaction that goes on here. You have methane and ammonia, and you can take hydrogen, and you can zap it either with lightning or you can zap it with sunlight, and you will get this strange material, glycine, which is an amino acid, plus hydrogen, which is released, and then either interacts with more chemical reactions or finally is lost from the atmosphere. But as I say, even though you have amino acids formed, you need to concentrate them. The concentration takes place in tidal pools. These are depressions that exist near an ocean. And the concentrating mechanism works as follows. When you have a high tide, the water is able to come into this depression, overcome the barrier between the depression and the ocean, and the water now, which has a weak solution of amino acids in it, is deposited in the basin. Then the tide goes down and you have a separation between the water in the basin and the water in the ocean. This water in the basin begins to evaporate. And over the course of many, many hours and days and months of evaporation, the amount of amino acid that is in the basin begins to increase. As a result of the increase in concentration, the amino acids then are able to react. They are able to form chains. These small chains are able to form bigger chains, and eventually, through some very complicated processes, the chains begin to build up to the complexity whereby you can get something that can reproduce itself. It doesn't have to be life at this point. All you need is something that is complex enough, made up of amino acids, that it is able to reproduce itself. And then if you have various kinds of complex chemicals that are able to reproduce themselves, they begin to work together along with the DNA that is being formed elsewhere or precursors to DNA, and eventually the whole system comes together. Some of the molecules become structural. Some of the molecules become enzymes. The DNA molecules become encoders, and the whole thing eventually begins to work together to form a cell. And then, of course, through division, the cell can continue to multiply, produce more cells that work together to produce more complex life. That is the scenario. And here is where it begins once you get out of the ocean, in the tidal pools, with the concentrating mechanism. Now, that's all part of the standard scenario. What evidence do we have for it? In 1953, a very famous experiment was done by a man by the name of Stanley Miller at the University of Chicago. He tried to simulate the early atmosphere. He used an apparatus that is depicted on the screen. First of all, let's start in the lower left and work our way around clockwise. He had a flask that had water in it, and he had a heat source represented by the alcohol lamp. At part A, halfway up, he introduced the gases that he thought would be prevalent in the early atmosphere. These gases are then taken along by the water vapor produced by the boiling water in the lower left, and the gases in the water then are carried to this large chamber on the upper right that has two electrodes in it, and a high voltage was put across the electrodes to give a spark, and that spark simulated lightning in the early atmosphere. You notice in that particular flask we have hydrogen, ammonia, water vapor, methane. You can put in other quantities as well. You can add nitrogen. Again, we don't add oxygen. And then after the sparking takes place, the water begins to condense, comes down to a condenser where it is facilitated. The condensing is facilitated. And then the water forms droplets, which eventually come down to this U-shaped tube, out of which Stanley Miller was able to tap some of the material that had formed. Originally, the apparatus was clear. The water was clear. The gases did not have any kind of color to them. He ran the apparatus, and then after a while, he found that the water was beginning to turn kind of a murky pink color. Eventually, it became brownish, and as he examined the water, he found that there were amino acids. And this has become one of the datum to show that this scenario of the early Earth forming amino acids really does work. Now, let me just make a parenthetical remark here. The very first time Stanley Miller tried this, he did not get amino acids. The very first time he tried this, what he got was gunky tar that coated his whole apparatus, and basically he had to stop the experiment, take everything apart, clean it up, and then start again. The second time, he introduced different ratios of gases, and he got amino acids. This particular experiment was repeated many times by him. Interestingly enough, the second time he tried it was really when he had the greatest proportion of amino acids in the mixture. Now, what that is to say is the following. This is not necessarily a proof that amino acids can form in the early Earth, because the early Earth could have produced tar and not amino acids. However, it does give a certain plausibility to the standard scenario. That is that amino acids could form on Earth by the constituents that we have, that we would have had in the atmosphere through the combination produced by sunlight and by lightning. But Stanley Miller's experiment is one thing that will be referred to over and over and over again as one of the proofs for the truth of the standard scenario. Here's an example of the apparatus. That is not Stanley Miller, by the way, over to the left. That is another experimenter who is heavily involved in this work. And this particular experiment, lightning was not used. That is, a spark gap was not used, but ultraviolet light was used to simulate sunlight. And that, too, is seen to work. That, too, has produced amino acids. Here is a before and after picture. On top, you see a very clear flask where the spark is produced. And then after a while, you will see that the flask is covered with this brown material. And upon examination, we find that that material indeed is amino acids. Very, very strong evidence that the scenario can produce amino acids in the early Earth. But there's more. There's more proof. As we look out into our galaxy, we find areas of enormous dust clouds, as depicted here in the so-called Rosette Nebula. We not only find that there's a lot of gas, but we also see that there's a lot of dust given by these black globs that are spread out over the picture. As a result of the astronomer's ability to detect not only light coming from these clouds, but also radio and microwaves coming from these clouds, astronomers have been able to find various molecules existing in these clouds. For example, if you take a look over to the left, these molecules have been broken up into those that are nitrogen-based with the N, carbon-based with the C, oxygen-based with the O, and sulfur-based with the S. And all this diagram is representing is the various combinations that can take place between these different kinds of molecules. The arrows point to the combinations. You notice the four boxes on the left can form the four boxes in the second column, and then those molecules can interact to form the materials that you find over here in the third column, etc. I want to focus your attention predominantly on one molecule, and that's here, two hydrogen, a carbon, and an oxygen. That particular molecule is formaldehyde. Formaldehyde has been found to exist in these large gas clouds that we find in the galaxy. Now, immediately you say, well, so what? Well, here's a so what. Formaldehyde can react with what is known as hydrogen cyanide. If I go back to the previous picture, you see hydrogen cyanide is one of the C-base compounds that can combine with one of the oxygen compounds. In fact, you see it right over here. Formaldehyde and hydrogen cyanide, carbon and oxygen, the hydrogen cyanide, can react with water that is present in these clouds to form glycine, another amino acid. In short, we don't even need an early Earth to form amino acids. Amino acids may be formed in large clouds in our galaxy. Now, I should say that no amino acids have been detected. It may just be a matter of time. It may be that amino acids really do form and break down very quickly. No amino acids have been detected, but complex molecules that can lead to amino acids have been detected. And so this becomes another evidence that amino acids may be forming not just on Earth, but also forming elsewhere in the galaxy. Just to bring that point home a little more, the dish with the dark material on the top part of the slide represents a meteorite, which in common parlance is called a shooting star. Now, this is a meteorite that has been carefully examined. Meteorites are materials that have been left over from the formation of the solar system. And upon examination of the meteorites that were not heated to very high temperatures ever in their history, guess what is found? Amino acids. And so this material that comes to us from outer space has amino acids in it. Again, it becomes proof that amino acids really can form. If not on the surface of the Earth, if we don't trust Miller's experiment, surely then we have to believe that amino acids can form outside of the Earth and perhaps be rained in on the Earth through the meteorites. Interestingly enough, the surface of the moon, the material, the soil on the surface of the moon also contains amino acids. That's not to say there was ever life on the moon, because the moon has been bone dry. But the amino acids that we find on the surface of the moon have come in from the meteorites that have crashed in on the moon and deposited the material there. That is to say, amino acids seem to be a common phenomenon in the solar system and certainly in the galaxy, whether we have it forming here on Earth or not. Well, what other evidence do we have? People have taken amino acids and have experimented with them. People like Fox have taken amino acids and heated them up and have found that they form little spheres. If you were to take a fast look at this slide, you'd probably think we're looking at cells, maybe bacterial cells like Staphylococcus. If you look at the division between the little ball and the outside, you look carefully on some of these, you will even see that there's a double layer of material separating the material inside the ball from outside. That's very similar to cells. Cells have a double layer. This is only superficial resemblance to cells. But if you read Fox's work, he feels that this also is another proof that cells could have arisen on Earth, that the complexity of the amino acids, their ability to get together and form cells, actually would work on the early Earth. And if you think this is impressive by looking at it superficially, take a look at another experiment that has been done by amino acids. These are so-called coacervates. These differ from the previous spheres. Here what is done, amino acids have been taken and mixed in with water. And it is seen that the amino acids are able to group themselves together, again with a double membrane, if you look carefully, and again we seem to have the appearance of cells. And so these things are also additional evidences that the standard scenario really can work. Let's continue. As I said earlier, what happens is we have chemical evolution very early in the Earth's history. This is what we have been discussing, this part of the standard scenario. The chemicals then are able to group themselves together with enough complexity to give us simple cells that are called prokaryotes. The prokaryotes are able to evolve into more complicated cells, eukaryotes, and then eukaryotes are able to form multi-celled plants and animals that eventually evolve into what we see today. We've already discussed the chemical evolution. Let's just take a look very briefly at the evolution between prokaryotes, the simple cells, and the eukaryotes, the complex cells. This is the basic difference between them. Eukaryotic cells are bigger, and the other difference that you really find is that the DNA is in a structure in the center, in the nucleus of the cell, whereas in the prokaryotes, the simple cells, the DNA is sort of spread out. So you have that size separation, primarily the size separation. Here's what's interesting. In various formations of rocks on the Earth that are dated back to 1.9 billion years, the so-called Gunflint Formation in Canada, the 3.2 billion year old Fig Tree Formation in South Africa, and the 900 million or 0.9 billion year old Bitter Springs Formation in Australia, careful examination of thin sections of the rocks have produced pictures like this. Look familiar? They look like cells. And close examination of these convinces individuals that these really are fossil cells that have been preserved in rocks that are very, very smooth, very, very fine-grained rocks. The size and appearance of these cells look like prokaryotes, the simple cells. Interestingly enough, in the really old material, such as the Fig Tree Formation and the Gunflint Formation that date 3.2 and 1.9 billion years ago, we find small-looking cells, small-looking fossils, that represent prokaryotes or simple cells. Later on, in the 0.9 billion-year formation in the Bitter Springs, we find eukaryotic cells. And so when we look at the fossil record, it appears that what we have had is an evolution from prokaryotes to eukaryotes, from simple cells to complex cells. This is just one photo. I want to show you some of these because it's fairly impressive evidence. This is the 1.9 billion-year-old Gunflint Formation in Ontario, Canada. I want to focus your attention to the left where you see little spherules of material. These represent, not represent, these appear to be, over here to the left, those appear to be very similar to the kind of material that is in existence today, basically blue-green algae. See the similarity between what I showed. Now look at this structure over here. This is blue-green algae that is alive today, that is a prokaryote, a simple cell. And just to flip back, notice on the left, the long stringy material, Here's the modern material. The similarity is uncanny. It appears as though we are looking at blue-green algae, simple cells, from 1.9 billion years ago. As we continue, here is a eukaryote down here on the bottom. This comes from the Bitter Springs Formation 0.9 billion years ago. It's longer, it's bigger, it looks like a eukaryote. We don't find eukaryotic cells before this time. Over here to the right, another prokaryote. Over on the bottom of this particular slide, these are modern bacteria, modern staphylococci. Look at this slide of the fossils up on top. I'm sorry, I don't know which formation the upper picture has been taken from, but I think you will see that the similarity, again, is just amazing. In short, it appears that some of the very structures that we see in cells today were in existence back then. But the main point is, the farther back we go in time, the further back we are, we find simple cells. And then we find the more complex cells. Again, it becomes evidence that we've had evolution from the prokaryotes to the eukaryotes. Well, that is the basic scenario. That's the standard scenario and the evidence that goes with it. And this is what is presented. And it looks pretty strong. Just to summarize, we have the basic constituents in the atmosphere. Through lightning and through radiation from the sun, we get our amino acids. I have only talked about the column on the left. I have not talked about the column on the right, which is a similar type of scenario for the formation of DNA. These amino acids form chains. The chains get together and form these microspheres of FOX, or the coacervates of other individuals. And then finally, you begin to get some working together of these things. And some of them become proteins. Some become enzymes. The nucleic material becomes the information bank for the cell. And finally, what you have is the first living cell, a simple cell that eventually evolves into a more complex cell. That's the evidence. And that is where the presentation normally ends. However, what I would like to do now is show some contrary evidence and some real problems with the standard scenario. First of all, let's go back to Miller's experiment. I already mentioned one of the problems with Miller's experiment, and that was that the first time he ran it, he found that we had gunky tar, and he did not have amino acids. And so the possibility exists that even though the early Earth atmosphere really was what we think it was, there's no reason to assume that amino acids necessarily formed. We may have just had tars forming and no amino acids. On the other hand, since so many of Miller's experiments have been repeated and we get amino acids, personally, I have no problem with believing that the early Earth's atmosphere could have formed amino acids. However, here's a problem. This particular chart, you'll notice some of the names on the left are in italics and some are not. The ones in italics represent amino acids that are prevalent today in living systems. The middle column, the relative yield, basically gives you the amount of material that is formed. That is to say, if we have 1,000 units of alanine form, we will have 557 units of glycine, etc., all the way down. You notice that from alanine and glycine, the amount of material formed is really very small. Now, here's what's interesting. If you take a look at the names that are in italics, if you take a look at the amino acids that are used today in living systems, you will find that it is not the ones that have the greatest yield. There are other kinds of amino acids that are formed and non-amino acids that are in greater abundance than amino acids that are useful. For example, you look down here at glutamic acid, you have 14 units formed compared to the 1,000 of alanine. On the other hand, between glycine and down here aspartic acid, you have amino acids with a very high concentration. Now, the question is the following. If indeed this is a good simulation of what happened on the early Earth, why doesn't life have more of the amino acids that are formed in greater abundance. That is to say, why has life chosen, to put it this way, why has life chosen amino acids that have relatively low abundance when chemically there is no a priori reason to do so? In short, if you have this kind of an abundance of amino acids, you would expect for life to exist today, which has come from these amino acids, you would expect life to have a greater quantity of the amino acids that have been formed by Miller's experiment. And so to put it another way, the concentration of amino acids that are used today in life is very different from the concentration of amino acids that are formed in Miller's experiment. And so what has caused the selection process? That's one problem. Second problem, best illustrated by this diagram, amino acids form with what we call two polarizations. That is to say, they form as mirror images, one with another. Now here's an illustration here. If you take a look at the way these two molecules are lined up, this is a very simple molecule of alanine, an amino acid. You take a look, in the center you have the carbon, and on the top you have this particular group of molecules. Suppose now you're looking from the top down, and let's see over here on the left how you go from CH3 to NH2 to H. As you look down from the left, in order to go from this molecule to this molecule to this molecule in that sequence, you have to go clockwise. On the other hand, in order to make that same sequence over here in the molecule on the left, in order to go from CH3 to NH2 to H, you have to go counterclockwise. And that is what we mean by polarization. See, one molecule is basically a mirror image of the other. Now, here's what's interesting. In all of the Miller experiments, the molecules that are formed, the amino acids they are formed, whether we're talking about the ones that are actually used or not, all of the molecules that are formed are 50-50 both polarizations. 50% of the alanine has this depolarization or right polarization. 50% has the left polarization, and that is true right down the line of all the molecules. Now, what does this mean? It is significant that life, as we know it, is made up only of the left-handed molecules and not the right-handed molecules. And so if life has arisen by chance, why haven't any right-handed molecules become incorporated in the amino acid structure when you have 50-50? By the way, I should say, the amino acids that have been found on the moon and the amino acids that have been found in meteorites that have come crashing here on Earth also have this 50-50 structure. And so a basic question that we have to ask ourselves is, why doesn't life represent this? Why aren't half of our amino acids right-handedly polarized and left-handedly polarized? Why are they all left-handedly polarized? And then when you go to the sugars that are used, why are they all pretty much right-handedly polarized? Now, you can say, well, that's just the way it was, but basically that becomes special pleading. See, if you're really going to have chance reactions of amino acids forming chains, you would expect roughly half of them to be L and half of them to be D, or half of them to be left, half of them to be right. But that is not the case. And so, again, I see this as a rather severe constraint, a rather severe problem as to the origination of amino acids that are useful for life strictly by natural means. A third problem. Remember the tidal pools that I mentioned that are needed for concentrating mechanisms. Notice that this particular pool is in the sun. The very sun that evaporates the water is also the sun that provides radiation that can destroy amino acids. And so it is difficult to have a tidal pool that will have the proper concentration of materials that you need that will not in itself be exposed to the radiation from the sun, and that very same radiation that breaks down the early molecules of the Earth will also break down the amino acids. In short, taking amino acids and concentrating them in a tidal pool and exposing them to sunlight
is going to have the effect of disassociating the amino acids, and trying to get them together is going to be very, very difficult. That is a problem. How do we get around that? Well, we construct an ozone layer, which, by the way, has been much in the news lately because of what's happening down in Antarctica. Here's a situation. On the left, there is no ozone layer. The sun's ultraviolet rays, which are also used to tan us, come straight down to the Earth, and without anything to absorb them, they become extremely detrimental to life. Those are the rays that would destroy the amino acids or any other complex molecules forming in the tidal pools. How do we block out the rays? We try to block it out with ozone. Ozone is a form of oxygen. Basically, the scenario is that the water vapor would break down into oxygen and hydrogen, and the oxygen then combines in a special way to give us the ozone layer. Ozone is very good at blocking out the sun's ultraviolet rays, especially the ones that are extremely detrimental to life. Ah, have we protected our situation? Have we protected our pool? Notice the problem. If you have oxygen to form an ozone layer, then you have oxygen to destroy the amino acids. Remember what I said concerning that oxygen has to be eliminated from the Earth. And so basically what we have here is a real catch-22. And that is, if we have enough oxygen to block out the ultraviolet rays, then we have enough oxygen to destroy amino acids. If we try to get rid of the oxygen so as not to destroy the amino acids, then we expose our tidal pools to the ultraviolet sun, which will do the job as well. This is a very, very difficult problem with the standard scenario. Now, here's the situation. Here's how the ozone layer forms. As I said, you get water. Radiation breaks up the water, the hydrogen escapes, the oxygen remains behind and forms ozone, but also destroys the material that we are trying to preserve. Well, one way out of this is to have caves, to have tidal pools that are caves next to the ocean, and the water then gets dumped into the cave, and the canopy of the cave, the top of the cave, basically protects us from our ultraviolet light. Well, that's a possibility, but you still can't escape. Early oxygen on the Earth is a result of the water vapor that is being broken apart into oxygen and hydrogen. And so you haven't escaped things totally by going to this kind of a structure. That, by the way, is the best thing I could find that shows a tidal pool with a covering on it. It looks a little bit like you're in a dentist's office looking down somebody's throat, but this is physical, not biological here. One other problem, which is the following. I've mentioned many times that in order to get the kind of structures of amino acids that we need to form chains of amino acids, and the chains of amino acids are formed by the chemical bonding of different kinds of amino acids. This is just an illustration of three of them forming together. Notice how the amino acids form bonds. Water is composed of two hydrogens and an oxygen, and basically to form bonds between amino acids, what we do is we pull off a hydrogen from one amino acid, and we pull off an oxygen and a hydrogen from another one, forming water, and then this nitrogen here hooks on to that carbon. Same situation here. Remove part of the water from here, part of the water from there, nitrogen hooks on to carbon, and that is what is referred to as a peptide bond. It's the nitrogen and the carbon combination. Notice, in order to form these chains, we have to remove water. But in the scenario that we have discussed, the material is in water. And so what happens to the situation in the tidal pool? How are we going to get the material to form bonds when it's in a water environment? Well, you might say the water completely evaporates. Well, that not only leaves amino acids behind, but it also leaves a lot of salt behind. Not just the kind of salt that we eat, but many kinds of salts that you have in ocean water. And so you have competition between the amino acids to begin with. As they try to form together, they keep bumping into salt molecules. And so that is a difficulty. What happens when water comes back into the tidal pool? The water then will dissociate the amino acids back into the component parts. Now, the illustration I like to use here, it's a little bit like being in a pool and trying to dry yourself at the same time with a towel. You just can't do it. There's just too much water around. This is a very severe problem that I see with the standard scenario. Well, my time is up, and so I won't get into the problems that you have with the DNA. Basically, by summary, let me just mention what I see with the whole amino acid scenario, and similar types of things could be said about the DNA formation or the proposed formation. My position is the following. I feel that on the early Earth, there is plausibility that amino acids formed. However, when I see all the other difficulties that I have mentioned, basically the quantities of amino acid, the ratio of the various kinds of amino acids, the difficulty with the sunlight and with the oxygen, the difficulty with trying to bond these things in water without invoking some kind of a special process, lead me to believe that the standard scenario as it's presented really is not a viable option. And so, as we look at these programs, or as we read the modern literature, the popular literature, that discusses all the evidence pro, I hope that someplace in the back of our mind, we can see that there's a lot of evidence against, and that we really won't be too keen to accept the standard scenario as it is presented, and in spite of the evidence that is presented. I think a lot of things are left out of that discussion, and hopefully when the other material that is left out is added in, I'm personally of the opinion that the standard scenario could not have happened. Personally, I believe that life as we know it was begun by God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and then he also interacted with the earth so as to form life upon it. And whether we're talking about life here only on earth, or whether we are talking about life on earth and elsewhere, if it does exist elsewhere, to me, I have to see it as a creation, because I see too many problems with the technique that is invoked, with the standard scenario that is invoked to explain that. Thank you very much for your attention. I will be very happy to answer questions. Again, I'm sorry for the sake of time that I have not been able to say things concerning the nucleic acids. That has kind of its own special set of problems that not only include all the problems we mentioned with the amino acids, but I would have to say that one of the major problems with the whole nucleic acid, and that is, as far as I know, those have not even been produced with the Miller's experiment. The material that is necessary for the nucleic material has not even been produced in similar experiments, the Miller's experiment. And so how you form those particular materials to begin with is still a problem, let alone how it's all going to work together to act as an information source. And so with that, I will leave my comments, and I welcome questions. Yes? A lot of it would depend on the depth of the pool. If the pool is too deep, then you've got a problem with the evaporation. You still have the concentration. You would still have a lot of material there. The membrane that forms will protect the material in the interior. And so you can get peptide bonds forming within these particular spherules. But the peptide bonds are very short. We would want peptide bonds that would be over 100 links long. And that is the difficulty, is forming that. And then getting these things to work together. See, so we're not just forming peptide bonds. We are forming long bonds, which is not formed, as far as I know, in the literature that I read. Peptide bonds have been formed that maybe are 6 or 7 links long, which is not nearly what you need. And then it begins to break down. And so it's not just individual amino acids here that are lumped together. I grant that that can occur. It is forming the bonds. And in the coacervates, what you have is the material forming very short bonds or loosely mixed. In Fox's experiment, what you have is the amino acids are taken in and of themselves. There is no water present. And basically, it is sort of put on a hot slab. And any water there would evaporate, and then material is able to come together. But see, things like that then redissolve the minute water comes in. Right. But as I say, those are very short bonds, or the amino acids that are just sort of mixed together. You certainly do not have the chaining effect that is necessary for the... No, I appreciate that. But again,
because there have been so many laboratories...
Right.
Potentially on your earth, and then this would even explain your sex rate, because you only need one successful Oh, absolutely. And in that laboratory, if a protein forms, then they would
be it's a big if, by the way. It's a very, very big if.
Out of all those laboratories, one would form. If it favored one polarization,
mm-hmm. All right.
And you would get that predominance of that pattern.
You're absolutely correct. In fact, that is exactly the answer that is given with the numerous ifs. Now, the problem with that I see is that chemically, the overwhelming reaction is to break these things down, or at least keep them from becoming long. Plus, when you look at just, see, what if you talk about just one lab necessary, I grant, by the way, that amino acids can form on the early Earth. If they can form in meteorites, if you can have formaldehyde and all these other things in gas clouds, I have no problem with amino acids forming. What I object to is the amino acids forming the kind of long chains that are necessary in order to form the complexity necessary for life, because the longer the chains become, the more easily they are broken down. Simply because you have, for one thing, a larger molecule, so you can zap more easily with ultraviolet light. You have a larger molecule, you have a greater surface area for the water to attack. And so I don't object to amino acids forming, and I don't object to short chains forming. What I object to is the enormously long chains that are necessary and the interaction between these chains in order to give a self-replicating molecule. But that, what you're discussing in terms of one pool being necessary, that's all that necessary, that gets into the whole question of probabilities, not just chemistry, but probabilities, which, again, is something that I did get into for time constraints. And personally, I'm convinced when you look at the probabilities that the case is so overwhelmingly against that scenario that I personally just have great difficulty in believing it. Bob.
I'll make my proposal there. As far as I know, no type experiments have ever produced a whole set of quantities.
Right.
Nor shown how to do that have produced all these other competing in the last
right.
Don't show up. And so what you typically have is you have a little pond here that might have some of them, a little pond here that might have some of them, etc.
Right, right. And I should say, not only is the Miller's experiment producing amino acids, various kinds of amino acids, but you actually have compounds produced that compete with the amino acids for other amino acids. That, for example, urea is something that is formed in these particular experiments. Urea has a great affinity towards amino acids. It has such a great affinity for amino acids that again, there's a question as to whether there'd be enough amino acids to enter into a reaction themselves when you have so many other chemicals that are forming that also have an affinity for amino acids. You see, so when you combine the chemistry and combine the probability, along with the problem that Bob just mentioned as to how you get these tools to work together, I just personally see a very overwhelming problem. Let me just say one more thing concerning chemistry, just to say something about the nucleic acids. The nucleic acids depend a lot on phosphorus. Now, phosphorus and oxygen gets together as a group and basically is part of what holds the DNA together. Again, one of the real chemical problems with the phosphorus is that phosphorus compounds precipitate out of water. They don't stay in solution. And so even if you were able, which is one reason why you can't form the nucleic acids. But see, part of the problem is that a very important chemical on the nucleic acid side precipitates out of water, gives such low concentrations that it's difficult to see how it could form the nucleic acids that are necessary. And so what you have is all the problem with the amino acids, all the chemical problems, all the probability problems, you have all the chemical and probability problems with the nucleic acids, and that somehow all this is supposed to come together someplace on Earth in order to give us a self-replicating mechanism. And as I say, if we just say it is possible, yes, it's possible, but the probabilities against it are weighted heavily against it. The chemistry is weighted heavily against it, and I personally just have difficulty with that. Play devil's advocate. Okay. Sure. Just don't get appointed to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
personally, let me just comment to that. I personally have no trouble with the dates, as many Christians don't have trouble with the dates. But what the problem is, whether the sequence of prokaryotes to eukaryotes really shows evolution, or is it showing creation? See, that to me is where the debate is in many circles. But go ahead. I just wanted to make that comment. I would say that the evidence fits nicely when a good bit of it is ignored. And I would say when you take the whole thing together, that it becomes an enormous problem. But regardless of what the probabilities are, regardless of what the chemistry is, if you're convinced God doesn't exist, that is really what you're going to go for. And so if the possibility against creation is really, if the odds are infinity to one, you know, then no matter how low the probabilities are for this particular scenario, that's going to be accepted. And so what I see there, in terms of the acceptance, again, at the risk of repeating myself, I think evidence is ignored. And there have been, however, secular people who have really faced up to this evidence and said, look, we've got a problem here. But they won't jump on the creation bandwagon. Basically, what they will say is, first of all, we've got to walk softly and not speak too loudly because there are problems. But let's continue to experiment and see if something will help us understand what happened. So you do find people in the literature now, especially within the last 10 years or so, you do find people in the literature now who have taken that position. You know, we don't understand it. We have difficulty with the present situation, but let's experiment. And so what I'm saying is a lot of whether the evidence is appealing or not depends on how much of it really is accepted, how much of it is ignored. And quite frankly, it also, I think, is based on certain theological and philosophical biases that individuals have as they come to the evidence. There are a lot of hurdles. Too many for my blood. Yes, sir?
I appreciate your scenario of spirit swimming. The biological membranes
in the problem. You had to need that, and not only that, but you have certain polarizations in the membrane and just the way things fit together and certain materials that let some molecules through and some others. I mean, the coacervates and the spherules are strictly superficial resemblance. Strictly superficial. Right.
Extremely.
Yeah, so looking like it's sort of like looking at a cardboard figure that policemen use and policewomen use to shoot at that has the shape of a human being. And say, well, it's just a very simple step between that cardboard figure and a human being. You know, that's the kind of thing that you find. Or to put it another way, another example I like to use, especially with the way Miller's experiment is used. Miller's experiment is, you cannot imagine how much emphasis is put on that to show that biological chemical evolution can take place. And the scenario that I like to liken it with is the following. And that is, we know that limestone, under a lot of heat and pressure, can form marble. But you cannot take that same heat and pressure, will not take the marble and form the Acropolis. And that is basically the step that people are trying to make between Miller's experiment and life, is they're taking a process that is known to work for the formation of marble and trying to form the Acropolis. And so, as I say, this is strictly superficial. Yes, sorry, Bob.
What they're going to try to do is start with something replicating it. That's all one thing. Maybe all protein, all something, nucleic acid. Then they'll change horses a couple times down the line. Develop the system we've got now, which is very tricky business, trying to figure out how some slightly complicated system of one type of molecule only is now going to change over to something with others.
Right.
The other remark is very much like the remarkable problem site. If you want to say, well, I'm only buying books, you only need to buy one book.
That's right. Very good. Yeah, very good. Very good. Yes.
I've heard it stated categorically that actually our present early atmosphere is not debatable.
There's still a debate on it. As far as I see, there's still a debate. It is fairly clear that the mixture
that was originally used by Miller is very much an error. Geologists who have studied very early rocks have said for a long time that is not the material that was present in the atmosphere. And by the way, it's the geophysicists who studied that that also questioned how much oxygen there may or may not have been. But in all fairness, the proposed atmospheres that have been used and the newer atmospheres, that is, ones that have a lot of nitrogen in them, have been able to form amino acids. And some experiments have put trace amounts of oxygen in there, and again, you've been able to form amino acids. So the real question is, what is that threshold of oxygen and just how much was there? And there are about five or six competing models around for the oxygen in the atmosphere. To get back to a comment that Bob made about switching horses in the middles, you have some materials that are replicating and then other materials, and then you sort of have to pull a switch. I wasn't going to get into Karen Smith's idea, and that is that clay is thought to be one of the ways in which the molecules can form these polypeptide bonds in water, even though it's in water. Basically, clay has the property that you have a crystal lattice in clay. And what is thought is that the clay actually holds these amino acids together with the right spacing and can also form the right sequence so that your chains can form in water. And then eventually you can get your membranes forming and all that to exclude the water so that this thing can become self-replicating and self-existent. And so what Karen Smith says is that really it is not the nucleic acids that became the original information source for the cell, but rather it's the clay particles. Well, see, then you run into the problem that Bob mentioned, and that is, how do you start out with clay and then switch to nucleic acids? But again, that is not part of the standard scenario. People don't discuss that on Cosmos, and they don't. And David Attenborough doesn't discuss it in Life on Earth or other things that have been done. Again, I want to emphasize, I'm dealing with the standard scenario. People see there's a problem. Other mechanisms are proposed, but those mechanisms also then have their own problem. It puts the burden of proof on us for design, but is it any worse than the burden of proof as to why the Earth has to be this size and why we need this much water? In other words, all we're saying is that the L and the R, the L and the D do work, and I may say it's design. I may not be able to figure out why it was designed that way, but the point I would make is that how naturalistically, how can nature design something that way if indeed it's done strictly by physical laws when both the chemistry and the probability are overwhelmingly against it. And so I don't see why that's really a burden of proof on me. I can say that, I mean, there just comes a level where I have to say if it's designed, this is the way it was, and leave it at that.
That could show that that was the only system that works. That basically naturalism say, well, that's what we've got that works. Now, if you can show the fact that very simple pictures of the world is extremely strange, then you get that.
Yeah.
I don't think we know enough.
No, we don't. All I can say there is something that a biochemist told me numerous years back when he and I were talking about life elsewhere in the galaxy, and some very exotic forms of life have been proposed, life based on chemicals that act supposedly like amino acids, but really work in ammonia rather than in water. Or perhaps instead of having carbon-based life as we have silicon-based life. And basically what he said to me is we have absolutely no evidence that life can exist in any other form than what we know it, which is what you said. And so here's a fellow who basically agrees with that. And as another person said, when exotic proposals are made for life based on some other kind of chemical reactions, as one fellow in the field said, look, we have a hard enough time trying to understand what life is as we know it, let alone trying to discuss what life is as we don't know it. And so you do run into those kinds of problems. So we'll see. Personally, I have nothing against the experimentation that has taken place. I'm all in favor of it. I think we're getting a lot of information. We are seeing how the intricacies of life, and to me, it is adding more and more emphasis to that statement that is in Psalm 139 that says, I have been fearfully and wonderfully made. And we see that that is not only on a macro level, that is also on a very micro level as well. And to God be the glory.